You are listening to a podcast from Raritan Valley Community College.
It's an honor and a privilege to introduce our distinguished guest, Cornell William Brooks. Dr. Brooks has dedicated his life to serving others. I asked him, who are the three most important people in your life? And he said, my wife and my two sons. How awesome is that? And then I also asked him, who influenced you the most? And he said, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. You are an inspiration and blessing to our world. Please welcome Dr. Cornell William Brooks.
Good afternoon. Now, we are in the midst of an incredible confluence of history between the celebration of African American History Month, having recently celebrated the birthday of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, and having inaugurated the 44th President of the United States, President Barack Hussein Obama. We are at a special, resplendent moment in history, and because of that, I'd like to believe that we have more of a celebratory spirit than that. So let's start again. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Here we go.
It is an absolute delight to be here at Raritan Valley Community College. I am very privileged to be in such an august and distinguished group of collegians. And I have to tell you, as a fourth-generation minister, I've not always been so fortunate to be in the presence of so many accomplished collegians and such a distinguished group of people. I want to share with you a true story, a rather humorous story that will underscore how fortunate I am to be in your presence. Many years ago, I found myself at a beautiful church in London, England, with beautiful Gothic windows reflecting the iridescent beauty of God. This beautiful Gothic cathedral with spires towering toward the heavens was such a inspiring architectural creation. I stood outside of this Gothic cathedral on a Sunday morning, looking inside and imagining that there were about 2,000 people waiting to hear this young, naive, innocent preacher preach. And I made my way into this beautiful church, and I immediately noticed the obvious: the pastor and exactly two members. But I did as I was taught to do in seminary, which is to say that you speak or preach to 2,000 two people in exactly the same way, with sincerity, with conviction from the heart. So I made my way over to the pulpit, and I began to speak to this pastor and his two members. And as I was pouring out my heart, I immediately noticed the obvious. One member, who I'll call Miss Smith, immediately fell asleep. But as I was speaking, I noticed that Miss Jones seemed to hang on to every word I had to say. She said amen at all the right times. She said hallelujah at all the right theological moments. She clapped her hands. She tapped her feet. And I thought to myself, at least I'm reaching one somebody today. I concluded my little homily, made my way out of the pulpit, made my way over to the pastor. And the pastor said to me, he said, Brother Brooks, you know, I'm just so sorry. Miss Smith, she falls asleep on everybody. And Miss Jones, she's out of her mind and did not understand a thing you had to say. So I am extraordinarily happy to be in the midst of so many people who appear to be in their right minds. I want to extend a word of appreciation to the African American History Month Committee, which convened this important occasion. And if it's not too much of an imposition, if I could just ask you to stand and represent yourselves and represent the work that you've done today, just right where you are, all the members of the African American History Month Committee, including Ms. Walker, if you could just stand, just right where you are, right where you are. I also want to take a moment to acknowledge the president of this Institution of Higher Learning, Dr. Crabo, a member of leadership, New Jersey, a graduate alumni, of course, the mayor, the councilwoman, my assembled brother clergy and sister clergy. I also want to acknowledge Ms. Fields, who is a trustee here and a pillar of this institution of higher learning. I'd also like to recognize and extend a word of appreciation to the Brotherhood and the Brothers Helping Brothers, because as men, you stand in the lineage of Paul Robeson and W.E.B. Du Bois and Albert Einstein as a man representing men, representing positive, constructive, redemptive masculinity. You stand for that which is great in our community, that which causes our sisters and our children to look up to you, to admire you, and want to follow you and walk beside you, and on occasion walk behind you, not as subordinates, but as supporters. We salute what you do. And because those of you who are part of and knowledgeable of the African-American church tradition are well aware of the fact that music plays a vital and important role in the celebration of the life of the Spirit and the celebration of the life of this democracy, we want to acknowledge the contributions of the choir present here today. And lastly, I want to acknowledge the presence of my wife, Janice Broom Brooks. If I could just ask you to just stand just for a quick moment. Since the hour is drawing nigh, I will speak briefly and hopefully forcefully on the topic, the quest for black citizenship in the Americas. This topic is one that has a relevance, a profundity at this moment in history. I'm thinking back to a cool, crisp morning, wrapped in the cold of winter, yet warmed by the hopes of a nation only a few weeks ago. There in Washington, I watched a democratic sacrament take place with the reverence of religion, and yet with the power of a democratic republic. Chief Justice John Roberts, holding the Bible of President Abraham Lincoln, administered the oath of office to then-President-elect Barack Obama. Barack Obama began his inaugural address with these simple, profound, evocative words, "My fellow citizens." That phrase, those words, that wording, "my fellow citizens," those words, "my fellow citizens," invoke stories, stories of triumph and travail, stories that are heart-inspiring and heart-wrenching, stories that literally wrap all of us, wherever we find ourselves, in whatever condition we find ourselves in a warm sense of somebodiness. Stories that may be cast as African-American stories, but stories that in their essential nature and character are really American stories. Some of these stories are recorded and authenticated by the best credentialed historians in places like Raritan Valley Community College, but some of those stories may also be heard by a grandmother talking to her child at the breakfast table. Some of those stories might be heard by a mother or a father speaking to their children at bedside, trying to instill in them a sense of excellence and a sense of somebodiness. Some of those stories may be heard around a picnic table at a family reunion, where the older folk are telling the younger folk, when the previous generation is telling the next generation, that you can do it, you can make it, you are in fact somebody because you come from somebody. Stories that are powerful and that represent collectively and cumulatively African American history. Stories embodied, represented by that simple phrase, "my fellow citizens. If you were there in Washington or watched the inaugural celebration on television, you heard those words, my fellow citizens. If you looked at the television screen or looked across the mall into the distance and saw our 44th president utter those words, my fellow citizens, perhaps if you looked behind him on those marble steps, you might have seen in your mind's eye, in your civic democratic imagination, a slave by the name of Dred Scott, who appealed his case, made his case before the Supreme Court in 1857, seeking his freedom. You might see Dred Scott on those marble steps. Perhaps you saw W.E.B. Du Bois, William Edward Burgat Du Bois. Perhaps you saw Mary McLeod Bethune. Perhaps you saw Ida B. Wells. Maybe Martin Luther King was there, or Phyllis Wheatley was there. Perhaps you saw in that cloud of witnesses Americans of yesteryear representing a history of struggle, stories of struggle, a quest for citizenship. I'd like to suggest to you that on that cool, crisp morning when Barack Hussein Obama took the oath of office for the presidency of the United States, Dred Scott was there. And Dred Scott, as you recall, appealed his case, took his case to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court yet declared through Supreme Court Justice Taney that a black man had no rights that a white man should respect. And that a black man, either slave or free, could not be a citizen of this republic. I yet believe that Dred Scott heard Barack Obama taking the oath of office as a citizen of this republic. And I yet believe that that quest for citizenship took a gigantic leap forward. And because of that, we as citizens of this republic, as heirs to Thomas Jefferson and George Washington, as heirs to W.E.B. Du Bois and Martin Luther King, we all took a giant step into the future together. And so just for a few moments, I want to talk about that quest for citizenship in the Americas under the topic, Just Tell the Story. Just Tell the Story. And specifically, I'd like to speak about storytelling as an act of social justice. Storytelling as an act of social justice. And briefly, I want to just touch on three questions. Where is our history? Who does it belong to? And what shall we do with it? Where is our history? Who does it belong to? And what shall we do with it? This year represents the centennial of the founding of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. This year represents the centennial of the founding of an organization that profoundly changed the course of human history in the Americas and in this America, the NAACP. And so when we talk about where do we find our history, our African-American history, our American history, I'd like to humbly suggest to you that our history is wrapped up in the history of the NAACP. Might I take you to the early chapters of this century, or rather the last century? Might I take you to Niagara Falls, New York, and Niagara Falls, Canada, when a group of black and white, multiracial, multiethnic, multicultural intellectuals came together around the cause of racial equality and justice in this country. They could not meet on the American side of Niagara Falls. They had to go to the Canadian side because of the segregation in their country. So they went to the Canadian side to plan for an organization, a campaign for social justice for the other side of Niagara Falls. So in 1905, they birthed the Niagara Movement. There were persons like Mary Ovington, and William Edward Burgat Du Bois. And those of you who are familiar with the intellectual history of the 20th century are well aware of the fact that W.E.B. Du Bois was an eminent and preeminent sociologist, first PhD in sociology from Harvard University, who went on to study at the University of Leipzig and came out of a humble little historically black college called Fisk University in Nashville, Tennessee. And so this collection, this constellation of great minds and great hearts birthed the Niagara Movement, which came into fruition in 1909 as the NAACP. And in the course of the NAACP's history of struggle, of a quest for citizenship to give us the right to vote for the candidate of our choice, to live wherever we choose to live, to exercise our imaginations, our aspirations, so that our children might have a better future than their parents' past. This organization represents our story. Where can this story be found? It can certainly be found on the gilded pages of the history books in your library. It can certainly be found in the lecture notes of your distinguished professors, but not only there. Certainly it can be found there. Certainly it can be found in a book that you can read, and that's certainly an important thing for us to do. But I want to suggest to you that the history, African-American history, is not merely to be found on the gilded pages of history books, but also in your family photo album. Might I suggest to you that history is not only to be found as in the province of eminent historians, but it is also to be found in the stories of your parents and grandparents. Might I share a personal story with you to make the message clear? When I was a little boy, my grandfather was an AME minister and a pastor, and he would tell me stories about his early civil rights days. I'm talking about before Martin Luther King came along. I'm talking about before Rosa Parks sat down that we might stand up. I'm talking about before those days, in the 30s and the 40s and the early 50s. My grandfather told me stories about his political engagement and involvement. And as a young man full of youthful arrogance, I didn't believe him. So one day when I was up at Yale Law School thinking I knew something, someone passed around a book of photographs of eminent African Americans. And there in that book was a picture of James Edmund Prelo, my grandfather. And underneath it said, James Edmund Prelo, candidate for Congress. And then I looked up the history and discovered that my grandfather ran for Congress following the Supreme Court decision outlawing the all-white Southern primary. He ran for Congress not because he thought he could win, but because he thought this democracy could win if we could register people to vote and give them the franchise. And I discovered that black history is not something to be found only in a book, but it can be found in the stories of your mothers and fathers who struggled hard to put you in Raritan Valley Community College, mothers and fathers who inspire you, mothers and fathers who work day in and day out to give you opportunities they never have and never dreamed of. History that is so powerful it can transform your character and challenge your conscience. History that is so powerful it can literally give a child an orbit around the sun. A child who's literally sent into a higher orbit, into the stratosphere of human ambition, human potential, and human aspiration. Stories that literally speak to who we are and who we can be. And so when you ask yourself the question, where's African-American history? Let me suggest to you, African-American history is in the hearts and the stories of your forebears. I've got to come to a second question. Whose history is it? There's a certain amount of academic balkanization that occurs on college campuses and in public schools, such that we relegate African-American history on a certain ethnic plantation. It's something that we think about, reflect on once a year during February, during an African-American History Month celebration. Might I suggest to you that African-American history is our history. As Americans, all of us own this history. All of us are heirs to this history. All of us can claim this history. All of us can tap the inspiration and the power of this history. The Hispanic child who reads about a young Martin Luther King, who graduated from Morehouse College reading not at the collegiate freshman level, but reading at the ninth or tenth grade level. The Martin Luther King who was a C student at Morehouse, who then graduated at the top of his class at Crozier Seminary, and then went on to get a PhD in systematic theology from Boston University. The Hispanic child reading about this African-American minister can yet realize, if he did it, I can too. It's your history. It's our history. The Asian child who reads about Ida B. Wells, a woman living in a man's world, watching lynchings go on, her people being persecuted, her people being brutalized, and yet took her pen and pricked the conscience of a nation. Perhaps there's a little white girl who's unsure of her intellectual capabilities. Might she read about an attorney by the name of Paula Murray? Anybody here know Paula Murray? Paula Murray was an African-American woman who applied for admission to Harvard University Law School and was denied. Went to University of California, Berkeley for law school, for a graduate degree in law. But then also went on to Howard University Law School. And while she was at Howard University Law School, she wrote a term paper in which she tried to persuade her professors that you could attack the doctrine of separate but equal using the 14th Amendment. Her professors thought it was preposterous. It was wildly ambitious. It was ridiculous. But this third year student then took her term paper, turned it into a book, and Thurgood Marshall used it to win the war against segregation. So don't tell me what girls can't do. Don't tell me what women can't do. That history is your history. You can claim it. You can call it. You can call upon it. And lastly, what shall we do with this history? What shall we do with it? Should we read it once a year? Should we peruse it with feigning academic curiosity? Should we glance at it? Should we speed read through it? Should we look for the cliff notes online? Nobody knows what I'm talking about. Might I suggest to you that if you delve deeply and profoundly into African-American history, it speaks to you. Not only do you read it, it reads you. Not only do you get something from it, it calls upon you to do something with it. What shall we do with this history? What shall we do with these stories? What shall we do with the stories that our parents pass on to us? Do we just listen? Do we do as I did as a young man? Be mildly amused by the musings of an older man and then go on, blissfully unaware of the profundity of history that I was given? No, let me suggest to you, we've got to do more than that. Because storytelling is an act of social justice. You see, when you tell your story, you can transform a life. When you tell your story, you can inspire somebody. When you tell your story, you can change history. Because the NAACP was started to tell the story of American racism. Their agenda involves speech making, as they described it, publicizing their cause and putting their cause before the American public, the American conscience. We've got to tell our story. Today, I heard a group of young men telling their story. You didn't simply provide the denotative and connotative meaning of words plucked from a dictionary. I want to suggest to you that every time you define one of those words, you were defining your possibilities, your aspirations, and your future. Every time you invoke those words, hope, change, and equality, you were telling your story, and in telling your story, you were transforming our story and giving us a new story. I want somebody to leave this place today committed to telling your story, telling your history. And not only telling your story and telling your story, but I'm calling upon you to analyze your story, to delve deeply into your story, and to use your story to transform someone else's story. As a lawyer, what we're called upon to do is to hear the stories of our clients, use those stories to draft legal complaints, to take those stories to court, to represent those stories, to argue from those stories, and to change the law to make a difference in people's lives. But what is true for lawyers is also true for business people. What is true for business people is also true for architects and engineers. You hear people's stories and literally take those stories and translate and transliterate them into a new reality. An architect who builds a building so that the homeless might have some place to stay. A doctor who takes an MD degree and transforms it into compassionate and affordable health care. An engineer who builds buildings that are not merely testaments and monuments to man's ego, but monuments to our commitment to ensuring that everybody has a place to call home. We've got to tell our story. Let me end with a humble story that may underscore how important I think this is. My bio will tell you that I'm a graduate of Yale Law School. What my bio does not tell you is that I'm a graduate of Head Start. Some of you may understand what that credential means. But as a young man growing up in South Carolina, my grandmother was blissfully unaware of the implications of the 13th Amendment, barring involuntary servitude. So she felt quite willing to lend my services out to all of her neighbors. And so my grandmother committed me to doing some yard work for one of our neighbors, Miss Alice Littman Teal. Miss Teal lived around the corner. I did her yard work, I mowed her lawn, and then afterwards she asked me a question. She said to me, "Young man, what do you want to do when you grow up?" I said, "Well, I think I want to be a lawyer." She said, "You think or do you know?" I said, "I know I want to be a lawyer." She said, "If you want to be a lawyer, I'm going to suggest to you that you go to Yale Law School." Well, I didn't know where Yale Law School was, and I had no intention of going there. And so she said to me, she said, "If you go to law school, I want you to go to Yale Law School because that's where my brother went." I said, "Your brother?" Now, this was a woman who was then in her 80s. She said to me, "My brother, Roger Demosthenes O'Kelly, graduated the Yale Law School class of 1912. He went to that school because other schools turned him down, including Gallaudet University in Washington, D.C. My brother was blind in one eye and totally deaf. And at Yale Law School, he met not African-Americans, because there were no African-Americans there except for him. He had white classmates who reached out to him, helped him, tutored him, took notes for him. And because of that, she concluded that that was a place I should go to law school." Well, she put in my mind, through her chapter in Black history, that I could do something, that I could aspire, that I could achieve. And today I'm telling you this story because I know you can achieve, you can aspire, you can accomplish, and you can be everything that God called you to be. Yes. Yes. And so this act of storytelling is a profound commitment to social justice, because every time you tell your story, every time you relay your story, every time you give your story to somebody, you are calling them and compelling them to do more than they thought they could do. Somebody here has a story today that should be inscribed in the annals of Black history. Somebody here today has a story that should be emblazoned in the chapters of American history. Somebody here today has a story so powerful, so poignant, that it is life-changing for you and for somebody else. Would you do me a favor? Just tell your story. Thank you.
You have just finished listening to a podcast from Raritan Valley Community College.